Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. 16 years after Bill Clinton famously declared, "It's the economy, stupid," it's still the economy. Poll after poll suggests a growing sense of financial insecurity among middle-class Americans, Republican and Democrat. This unease is not lost on the presidential candidates. Here's Barack Obama at the DNC in Denver.
In Washington, they call this the ownership society. But what it really means is that you're on your own.
And last week in St. Paul, John McCain also acknowledged the growing sense of financial distress across the land.
These are tough times for many of you. You're worried about keeping your job or finding a new one. And you're struggling to put food on the table and stay in your home.
This hour, On Point, why the U.S. economy has failed the middle class and maybe what to do to revive the American dream. You can join the conversation, what explains the end of mass upward mobility. Even when the numbers show a growing economy, why are wages flat for most Americans? What's your theory about the challenge and how to address it? And joining me now in the studio is Peter Temin. He's a professor of economics at MIT. Last year, he co-authored a paper with fellow MIT economist Frank Levy that's received a lot of attention in policy circles. The paper is a bit of a history lesson about how the American dream was built and why it has stalled. And Peter Temin, good to have you in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with this concern about wages and this idea of sort of a decoupling, I guess, of American productivity, which the economy continues to grow, and yet the average American doesn't seem to be accruing those advantages of an expanding economy in the way it once did. How flat are these wages?
Well, they're very flat. This seems like a paradox. The government reports that income is growing rapidly and people don't feel it. They don't feel it because real incomes, that is to say, incomes in terms of what you can buy with your income, have remained essentially flat since about 1980. That's a long time. That's getting to be 30 years in which people have not seen an increase. And now with prices rising, it looks, we don't have the data yet, but it looks as if real incomes may actually be falling at the moment.
And it's true that we lived through a recovery, and I guess this is the first recovery in history where Americans actually, the average American, didn't experience that recovery in terms of better wages, correct?
Yes, that's a correct statement, but we have to be careful who we're talking about. In my work, I tend to use the median worker, that is to say, the worker in the middle, ranking all workers, all people from the poorest to the richest, the middle person, how is that person doing? When you can also use the average, although that's affected by the upper tail. There are people who are doing well, but disproportionately they are very rich. Typically the people who are doing the best are the people at the very, very top of the income distribution. So the top 1%. 1% of the people have done very well, but the bottom 99% have not done nearly as well.
It seems like there's this idea in the core almost of American DNA, this idea of upward mobility. And to use the cliche that you hear again and again, but I think it's used again and again for good reason. You know, the idea in American that you work hard, you play by the rules, you can do better than your parents. This is sort of, you know, part and parcel of this great American dream. It seems like that's slipping away for a lot of people.
It is slipping away for a lot of people. And, you know, without rising incomes, it's hard for your children to do better than you have done. It's hard for over your lifetime to have a sense of increasing command over resources. And it's very problematical. Also, I might mention, it's not a focus of my work so far, but the educational system has been allowed to atrophy at the moment. And so the path for your children to go through school and to be able to get a better job than you have has also been blocked. And so there are direct and indirect effects.
I want to talk about this paper that you wrote, which provides a bit of a history lesson. And here's where I want to start, if it's okay with you. And that is this post-war era, even before the post-war era, say post 1930s, FDR comes into power, takes office. We're coming out of an economic depression. From that point forward, we see this amazing growth of the American middle class. It really is this idea of mass upward mobility, and we create essentially a new class of Americans that can do all kinds of things that couldn't do before. What happened to make that possible? What did government do to make that possible?
That's exactly right. And the story starts in the New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt put in response to the Great Depression, which gave unions the right to organize. Of course, this may have been irresistible given all the upsets at that time, but that was after a great legal battle enshrined in law. And then in the great expansion of income after the war, the great post-war boom that affected the U.S. and Europe, the workers were able to solidify these gains in what we called in our paper the Treaty of Detroit. This was a famous treaty between the United Auto Workers and General Motors in 1948, as extended and revised through the 1950s, that for the General Motors, for the businesses, gave them labor stability, and for the workers, gave them an increase with productivity, increasing wages, as well as a cost of living allowance. Mm-hmm. So it protected them and gave them progress. This was a win-win situation for these people, and it was supported by the framework of the government. That is to say, to force companies to bargain collectively with unions, to allow for union elections, to create the framework into which then workers and businesses could come to this agreement.
So there was, sounds like you're describing a real sort of teaming up between corporate America and its workers.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Now, the explicit teams were done between big unions and big companies, but the extent of this spread pretty much throughout the economy. You have something called, which labor economists called pattern bargaining, which is, it sets a pattern for other firms and other labor organizations to use.
You also talk in the paper about a number of other institutions that made the growth of the middle class possible: fair trade practices, regulation, and relatively steep marginal tax rates on high incomes.
That's right. Yeah. So that you have to think government policy tends to be consistent through this, and so it's not just having the National Labor Relations Board and promoting fair business practices. It's also what you do with other incomes. And tax policy is a good indicator of the general attitude of the government. And so throughout this expansion, income taxes were quite progressive. The rates on income taxes were quite high for high incomes. And that was something that lasted roughly till about 1980.
And I want to talk about in a moment what happened there in 1980. But first, during that period of this great middle class expansion, this boom, give us a sense of the way wages reflected overall productivity. I mean, we started this hour talking about the economy is continuing to expand today. Wages are not. In that era, what was happening with wages?
Yes, that makes quite a dramatic graph. If you look at the period from about 1950, when we can first get the good data to do this, and up to 1980, then the median worker's income rises with productivity. That is to say, this was truly, in John Kennedy's famous words, a rising tide that lifted all boats. Hmm. And so it came up, not everybody, of course. The median worker leaves out things. This extension didn't go to African Americans so much. Women weren't so much in the labor force. There were problems. We don't want to say this was nirvana, but the grand mass of people, the people we now call middle-class people, their incomes, their real incomes, their command over resources rose with productivity. So they were able to buy houses, they were able to buy cars, they were able to take vacations, all these things that we think are the kind of basis of modern middle-class life.
Now, we mentioned that there's a big change that happens in 1980. We're about to go to a break, but let me sort of get you to just sort of tease the idea. What happens? What happens in the late 70s and the 80s that begins to turn this around?
That's right. There's a big change in policy. It comes for a whole variety of reasons through the great first oil crisis and the change, shift to Republican government under Governor Reagan. But it led to a change in government policy. So the context in which workers and employers work changed rather dramatically right at the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about why the modern American economy seems to be failing its middle class. You can join the conversation. What's your explanation of why the middle class is falling behind? How would you restore the dream of mass upward mobility? My guest this hour has been Peter Timman, professor of economics at MIT and co-author of a study that's been attracting a lot of attention among economists and policy people. And Professor Timman, we were talking before the break about this change in the late 70s and then with the Reagan Revolution in 1980. Talk about what happened there. The Reagan Revolution, perhaps sort of one of the most famous phrases from President Reagan was, government is not the solution, it's the problem. And he sort of came along and looked at sort of taking apart a lot of these institutions that you're talking about, right?
Yes. Well, let's take it from specifics to general thing.
Sure.
The specifics, Reagan famously broke the PATCO strike, signaling...
The air traffic controllers, yeah.
Yes, signaling an opposition to unions that had not been there before. He cut taxes on high incomes, the precursor of the famous Bush tax cuts that are an issue in the campaign today. And then more generally, with this notion of government as the problem, began to try to start to dismantle the New Deal, again, which showed its echo in President Bush, the current President Bush, attempt to privatize Social Security, was part of this program to roll back the New Deal to conditions earlier than that. Now, government can be a problem. Corrupt government, inefficient government, government that hounds people, that doesn't observe the rule of law, certainly can be a problem. But in advanced industrial societies, or should we say advanced informational societies like ours, government also can do great benefit. You can't have a functioning government can't have a functioning economy without a functioning government that ensures property rights, that keeps the wheels of commerce going. And government also has the power to share the benefits among all of these people. And that's what we could see under this system that we called the Treaty of Detroit.
So is it your argument that we should return to the kind of structure and regulation and institutions that shaped that post-war economic boom?
Well, history is always informative, but alas, it only runs in one direction. You can't go back to what we had before. The economy has changed. There's all the intervening history. But there are things that one can do. One could increase education, as we did earlier. That will certainly help people to some extent. It's not the whole solution, but in order to correct this, we have to do a number of different things. One could increase tax rates on high income earners, signaling that the government's intent was to share prosperity more widely. One could change the government attitude toward unions, that is to say, not promote unions, but make it a more level playing field as it was earlier under the Treaty of Detroit. So that would mean depoliticizing the National Labor Relations Board, trying to enforce compliance with what is labor law today.
Mm. Peter Temin, stand by. I want to bring another perspective into this conversation. Joining us from Washington is Brink Lindsey. He's vice president for research at the Cato Institute. He's also author of The Age of Abundance, How Prosperity Transformed America's Politics and Culture. And Brink Lindsey, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I know you've been standing by patiently and listening to Peter Temin. Let me start sort of with you with this first question. Do you accept the basic idea that the middle class is slipping behind and that there's good reason for what seems to be pretty pervasive insecurity across the land?
Well, there's good reason for economic insecurity right now. We're heading into a recession. We've had a financial meltdown. We've got rising energy costs, rising unemployment. But looking over the longer span, I would have to disagree with Professor Temin's assessment that the middle class has been stuck and that living standards haven't risen for the better part of a generation. There's a great...
So you disagree with the basic idea that there's been increasing inequality sort of creeping into the system?
No, that's not what I said. Mm. What I said was that people in the middle have experienced... a real and significant increase in material living standards over the past generation. There is a big statistical food fight about how to measure this and how to measure real income and so forth. But the most recent and careful study I'm familiar with is one by Terry Fitzgerald at the Minneapolis Fed. He looks at median incomes between 1975 and 2005, so basically the long period that Professor Temin was talking about. He says that median wages over that time, real inflation-adjusted median wages, rose 20% over that period. And if you factor in fringe benefits, then compensation went up 26%. On top of that, these real numbers adjust for inflation, adjust for changes in the price level, but they can't adjust for all the new products we have today that we didn't have 25, 30 years ago.
What do you mean? What are you talking about? You mean conveniences in the household?
Yes. All right. Personal computers, the World Wide Web, email, anti-lock brakes, ibuprofen, DVDs, CAT scans, all kinds of things, all kinds of medical technologies, communications technologies. House size, median house size has increased significantly over this period. So in terms, I think anyone really with, you know, who's lived through this period and reflects what how typical people lived materially back in 1980 would be hard pressed to argue that people, ordinary Americans, don't live materially better today. Now,
but let me jump in here for 1 second because I just want to be clear about what you're saying. It seems like what you're talking about sort of averages in a way, though, aren't you? I mean,
talking about people in the middle, not averages, people in the middle, median.
Mm. Hmm. But you're also talking about lists of things and consumer comforts. I mean, does that necessarily mean that people's wages are increasing?
Well, as I said, the best calculation I know of says that over this 30-year period, wages went up 20%, and that number doesn't reflect the new things you can buy with your money. And the reason we get income is so we can buy stuff. That's the point of it.
Okay.
So ultimately, it's living standards that matter. But let me say I do completely agree that income paths have diverged over this period. During the early post-war decades, incomes at the bottom of the distribution rose faster than those at the top, so there was convergence. Over the past generation, it has been different. People at the top have been gaining much faster than people in the middle or at the bottom.
Mm.
Inequality is real. Yeah. It's a real phenomenon. But I think one can recognize that without then going overboard and arguing that ordinary Americans have had stagnating living standards over the past generation, because I think that's manifestly untrue.
Well, I want to get Professor Temin, why don't you respond to Brink Lindsey about this? I mean, he has a different set of numbers that suggest things aren't as bad as...
Well, we don't want to spend time on the radio debating whose numbers are right.
I agree.
And so on. It is right to focus on the median worker. That's what we do, too. And there are a lot of estimates that go. Of course, there are new products, and there are always new products. And there are two questions about the new products. One is whether they are counted in the data that we use to talk about real incomes. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been trying to deal with this problem. We can debate how successfully they are, and people have been talking about that for a long time. The other thing is to recognize that income patterns change. You know, we didn't drive cars before there were cars. We had horses before horses. We walked. You know, there are all kinds of changes. Not all of them mean the increase in real income. Some of them just are changes. And it's a very difficult thing to disentangle whether we're talking about change or increase.
Mm. Let's go to Don, who is calling from Ogdensburg, New York. Hi, Don.
How are you today?
Thanks for taking my call, Anthony. Good to have you.
I just wanted to make the point that I couldn't agree more with the professor's analysis of how we've gotten to where we are today. And just wanted to ask the question of how he thought about the point that former Labor Secretary Reich made in his most recent book that talked about the fact that much of what governs American policy today is tested against the measure of by and for the corporations as opposed to of by and for the people.
Hmm.
And was wondering how he felt about that and if that was something that might be changed in Washington.
Well, that's a question for Peter Temin.
Yes, thank you. A very good question. And that's what in our paper we call the Washington Consensus is a way of saying that we want to have competition. We want to make life easy for companies to and corporations to expand without worrying very much about what happens to workers.
Hmm. Brink Lindsey, do you want to respond to Peter's call from this idea that it seems to Peter, and I think to a lot of people who are going to hear who are calling in, that government policy does seem to be tilting toward the corporations rather than the individual?
Well, I want to back up and take a look at the economic institutions that were in place during the early post-war decades, the so-called Treaty of Detroit institutions, and see if they are any kind of model for us today. First, as Professor Temin has noted, there was heavier unionization back then. I don't think the experiences of the automobile industry, the steel industry, the airline industry indicate that heavy unionization is necessarily good for promoting prosperity over the long term. Secondly, the reason we had high unionization back in the 50s and 60s is because unions were supported by a larger policy environment of much greater protectionism against foreign competition than we have today. And secondly, pervasive price and entry regulation of the energy sector, transportation sector, communication sector. So we had a much less competitive economy. We were shielded from foreign competition through protectionism. We were shielded from domestic competition through regulation. And therefore, unions could contribute to wage compression and to higher wages for unionized workers because those costs could be passed along to consumers. In a competitive environment, that can't happen, and therefore unions have shrunk. But does Professor Temin really think that it would be better to go back to the kind of systematic throttling of competitive forces we had in the days of economic regulation and protectionism?
Well, I'm not sure that he characterized it that way, but why don't we let Peter Temin respond to that question?
Thank you. Yes, we like these non-emotional terms like throttling back in our discussion. For the thing is, I just make two points. One is, of course, even though Mr. Lindsey says that there was no competition, do want to point out that the rate of economic growth was very rapid in this period, and so raises all kinds of questions.
And do you think it was rapid because of this regulation?
I think that partly had kept the economy going, and so I think, yes, that contributed to it.
So, price controls on,
okay, Brink Lindsey,
on energy, price controls on trucking
no,
and railroads,
No, price
all
controls
that was good stuff.
Were put in by Nixon in the 1970s because he didn't know what else to do.
No,
they
I'm
were in
about,
during the war with
I'm
Roosevelt,
talking,
but they
right,
were
I'm
not
talking,
there.
I'm talking about rate regulation. I'm talking about entry controls.
Oh, you're talking about, well, we know what happens when you don't regulate
monopolies
today.
Talking about airline regulation.
Let's go to Linda, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Linda. What's on your mind?
Hi. Speaking as an historian, I would say that we know exactly what to do. When the government supports the workers with encouraging union, with earned income tax credits, with keeping a relatively balanced budget, with providing help for education, the economy does better. And we have a perfect example if we look in the 90s. Bill Clinton did balance the budget. He increased the earned income tax credit, and that is the only time in the past 30 years when wages were not stagnant, when they did slightly increase for the middle class.
Okay, Linda. Well, thanks for putting that on the table. Let me put that to our guest, Peter Temin. We hear a lot of people talking about things improving somewhat during the Clinton years. Do you agree with that? Was that?
Yes, I agree with the caller, and I think that was a not as good a time as people have had, but a move in the right direction for all the reasons that she said.
Yeah. So there were government policies put in place then, including the earned income tax credit.
Yes,
I think that often stands out.
These were
out.
Good policies.
Frank Lindsay, do you disagree with our caller on this point?
I don't, when we're talking about how to go forward,
sure.
What to do, I think that some kind of redistribution has always been a part of our policies in the modern era and should continue to do so. I think some move towards a more progressive tax structure is acceptable and could mitigate some of the lagging economic growth at the bottom end through tax relief that's more aimed towards people at the bottom and paid for by taxes on people on the top. I think that's all okay. That's very different, though, from the kind of pervasive government regulations which restricted competition, restricted who could go into the trucking industry, who could go into the airline industry,
what prices
they could charge. It's very different from the kind of protectionism we had when in the 50s and 60s average tariffs were over 10%. They're about 2% today. And all of this edifice of regulation and control, which Professor Temin is celebrating, was torn down during the 70s and 80s, but it wasn't just by ideological conservatives. Ted Kennedy was the author of Airline Deregulation. Ralph Nader was a prominent critic of trucking regulation. Bradley and Gephardt, Democrats, were authors of the Tax Reform Bill of 86, which brought top rates down to 28%. Mm-hmm. So there was a wide consensus amongst people across the spectrum that the old regulatory structures were inhibiting growth and needed to be changed. And so to go back with sort of nostalgia for the good old days of economic policies that I think were wrongheaded at the time, were revealed to be wrongheaded during the disastrous economic performance of the 70s, is a diversion from the problems that we are facing today.
Okay, Brink Lindsay, we're going to pick up that point after the break. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the middle class and the disconnect between wages and the American economy. They seem to be going in different directions. My guests this hour are Peter Temin, professor of economics at MIT, and Brink Lindsay, vice president for research at the Cato Institute. And Peter Temin, before the break, Brink Lindsay was making the point that to go back to the kind of regulatory structures we had in the post-war period would not work.
Yes. Well, Mr. Lindsay confuses history and nostalgia. History is the story of how we got to where we are. Nostalgia is to want to go back. But there's nothing in what I've done to indicate that going back is a good thing. But what we want is to go forward to do policies, of which Mr. Lindsay was talking, which will move us in that direction. I would add improving education to his list, and then we might be in reasonable agreement.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Glenn is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to make a quick point. There is an interesting study done by some University of Chicago economists, which basically looked at how prices have been changing for the middle class versus for the rich, and it showed that while prices have basically been flat or coming down, actually, for the middle class because of imports from China, they've been rising much more rapidly for the rich because the prices of wine and, you know, fine services have not been declining. And so that counteracts some of the increase in inequality. I think they found that something like 50% of the increase in inequality has actually been counteracted by changes in prices for different incomes.
So prices down because of Chinese imports, because of big box retailers like Walmart, I suppose. Peter Temin, what do you think? Does that sort of counteract some of the inequality?
Yes, all these things matter. It's a very complicated world. The Bureau of Labor Statistics tries to have different price indices for different groups to account for this, and we can debate how well it does. But right at the moment, the poor consumers are suffering from high food prices and higher heating bills and gas prices. And so I'm not sure that that mechanism is working right at the moment.
Mm. I want to bring another. Glenn, thanks for that call. Let me bring another voice into this conversation. Joining us now from Washington is Steve Leisman. He's a senior economics reporter for CNBC. He was formerly senior economics reporter at The Wall Street Journal. And Steve, good to have you. Thanks for standing by so patiently.
Great to be here and a really interesting conversation to listen to.
Well, thanks. We wanted to bring you into this to sort of move this conversation forward a little bit and talk about what we're hearing on the campaign trail from the presidential candidates. Are either of them, in your view, talking about these big structural questions about how to sort of deal with the stalling of this idea of mass upward mobility? Or what are you hearing out there?
Well, it's probably good to look at the recent history here. And the answer is they were going to. It was, back in the spring, perhaps, or even before that, as these gentlemen put their economic platforms together, certainly for Barack Obama, the main economic parts of the platform were going to be about this income inequality story. The trouble is things like housing and the recent economic downturn have really overwhelmed the economic discussion inside the campaign, so that what you find is when you look at their platforms and follow their websites and their statements over time, what you find is a set of essentially jerry-rigged economic ideas that have been really designed to respond to the kind of news of the day and the changing sense of the electorate that really doesn't all add up to a huge philosophical idea behind their programs.
Mm. Isn't Obama, though, talking about a middle-class tax cut and higher marginal tax rates for very wealthy Americans?
Yeah, he is. And it's well to kind of put that all, I think, into context. And the way I think about it is, if I use the terms that Professor Temin has used, the Washington consensus is probably in a little bit of retreat right now, but the battle is still being fought on the grounds of, again, his term, the Treaty of Detroit. And here's what I mean by that. Obama's talking about putting back the top-tier tax rates that were cut by Bush. So we're talking about a 36% to 39%. Hmm. The kind of tax rates that were in place in the 70s were like, 70-80% in the top tier. So there's the discussion is over in the Republican camp. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, what do you have in John McCain? A relatively moderate Republican. There are no massive new huge tax cuts on his proposal, in any of his proposals. So fundamentally, that's where the battle's being fought, very much in the center right now, and we're not on the verge of a new Reagan-era revolution, but we're most certainly not on the verge, and Obama's not talking about this, of some kind of revisiting of the government programs that Professor Temin argues brought us that greater income equality.
All right, Steve Leisman, stand by. We're going to take a call or two more. So let's go to Mike, who's calling from Somerville, Mass. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. My comment had to do with the idea of working for a corporation in the first place. I guess it's less about the policy. My point is that working for a corporation is a lot like renting instead of owning your own house. So if the corporation gets sold or bought or has layoffs, what have you, you could be out of a job. And then, as nice as all this conversation is about taxes and who pays more and who pays less, if you don't have a job, the tax code really doesn't apply to you at that moment. So you're sort of stuck. And so I guess my point is that the government really doesn't seem to have much of a policy to allow for that. Maybe some of the severance of the CEOs, the company is sold, the CEO leaves with, $10 million of severance. Maybe some of that could go into bigger unemployment insurance for all those workers who've lost their jobs.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think you bring up an interesting point, and this shows up in surveys that we look at across the country. And Brink Lindsey, let me sort of throw this idea to you. One of the things that sort of shows up in survey after survey after survey and if we can get away from this sort of discussion about the minutiae of policy, is this broad theme of economic insecurity and this sort of idea that lots of Americans, possibly Mike is one of them, are sort of one emergency away from economic catastrophe, be it a layoff, you know, a death, a divorce, a sickness. And so the idea that the social safety net has been badly frayed. Do you see that as a, acknowledge that as a problem that a lot of people are worried about?
Well, I think that that the issue of economic insecurity and economic inequality are critiques of economic growth and prosperity. That yes, we're having growth and prosperity, but we're nervous about it, or it's not being distributed equally. In terms of how this fits into the campaign, things change when you start going into a recession. We stopped critiquing how economic growth feels or how it's being distributed. We start worrying about just getting it started again. So I think what we've seen in the campaigns is a shift away from these kind of bigger think topics of inequality and insecurity and a move towards ultimately managing the day-to-day crises of an economy in trouble. But both candidates, and I agree very much, are operating within, Professor Timmons' terminology, the Washington consensus. Yes, Obama is talking about economic inequality, but his proposals are first, not to interfere with markets, but let markets do their job and then redistribute through the tax code. And his redistribution through the tax code is pretty marginal. It's not going up to the Treaty of Detroit days of 90% or 70% tax rates.
Hmm. Peter Temin, do you want to chime in there? What do you see out there on the campaign trail and the proposals and the way these issues are being talked about?
Yes, large bonuses to CEOs and people at the top of the system, like Freddie Mac and so on, walking away with large bonuses just accentuate the problems that less fortunate people are having. And there is something in the kind of tone of government policy that tends to change these things. But I agree with what Mr. Leisman and Mr. Lindsay are saying, that Obama is moving slightly in this direction, but no one is advocating going back to the Treaty of Detroit. We had it there. It worked well at that time. We're going toward more kinds of things now. But the debate over tax policy is perhaps the most salient one to indicate the direction in which the other parts of economic policy will go to.
Can I just raise a very quick point?
Sure, please. Steve Leisman, go ahead.
Was a really interesting paper, certainly a great history lesson and a great reason to think about government programs and their roles. But I would be interested in this idea of why the market is not working when it comes to income distribution. Before we begin a wholesale resurrection of these government programs of a higher minimum wage, I think the paper maybe fails in that regard to tell us why the market fails and there's a nexus there for government intrusion. I think if we could do this through the market, you started to get at some of that when you talk about why are these executive salaries so high. It's not the Bush tax cuts end up kind of skewing a little bit the after-tax income inequality, but they're not the cause of it. It's the pre-tax income going into the Bush tax cuts that is, in essence, would be the source of that income inequality. It's not the Bush tax cuts themselves. And I suppose this idea, Professor Temin, on this moral suasion concept, on the tone of government that is accepting of it, is interesting, but I have my doubts that it's the actual sole source of it.
Hmm. Yes. What do you think, Peter Temin?
These are incredibly complicated questions. I think that one of the things that lies behind Mr. Lindsay's arguments is that competition left by itself will solve these problems. It's very hard to know what competition left by itself would do because you can't run competition by itself. Competition needs to have a good government behind it. And how the government sets the context for competition affects the distribution of income. Now, we can debate for a long time how this whole set of historical things that we talked about worked and why it worked and so on. And that would lead us to thinking today what could be done to recreate not the way it was done, but some of the results of what was done.
Hmm. Yes, of course, I think Professor Timmons is caricaturing my position. Of course we need government to structure the rules of economic life. But the question is, are we going to have government structure the rules so that we have competitive markets or so that we have cartelized markets? We had pervasive cartelized markets during the Treaty of Detroit days. The Washington Consensus move, which was, a move that that had supporters across the ideological spectrum, was a move towards letting markets work to produce, to make the pie as big as possible. Then we can talk about redistributing some of that pie if we want to. But first, make the pie as big as possible. And the idea that the kind of pervasive market interventions that were the norm during the Treaty of Detroit have anything to tell us about how to make the pie bigger today seems to me to be wrongheaded.
But Mr. Lindsay's ducking the point as well. I mean, it's as incumbent upon the supporters of the free market system to explain and try to solve the issues of inequality as it is the detractors out there.
No, I without a doubt, the people at the top of their fields, whether they're CEOs or investment bankers or lawyers or sports stars or movie stars, are making a lot more today than they did a generation ago, and their income growth has been much faster than anybody else's. There has been a bidding war for top talent. There's a very vast and nuanced economic literature about the rise of winner-take-all or tournament markets. I think we have markets that are much bigger today, so that when top performers get their slice of the pie, it's a bigger slice because the pie is bigger. We see that in finance. We see that in sports salaries. Also, we have more competition for top talent. The switch to free agency in sports allowed the top sports stars to earn a lot more because now people were free to bid for their services. In the same way, more competitive industries and a lower tax rate have allowed more bidding for top talent. Mm. And so definitely in that case, Professor Timmon is right on, I think, that the reduction in the top marginal tax rate has affected pre-tax incomes as well as post-tax incomes. But I don't think that that means that a 70% or a 90% tax rate was a good idea at the time or it's a good idea today.
Okay, I want to try to make room for one more call, but first I want to say that this is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's go to Lynn, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. And Lynn, our time runs short, but glad to have you on the show. Let us know what you're thinking.
Hello, Anthony. How are you?
Good.
Just coming in to say, I mean, in terms of prices, I mean, everything, I noticed it, and everyone does in the middle class, everything is higher. Groceries are higher. Our heating bills this winter are projected to be much higher. I live in the Northeast. It's cold. And a lot of, I mean, I lived in see that, you know, the dismantling of a lot of the deregulation that was done in the 80s. I think it's precipitated a lot of this, you know, what's been done to our economy, basically dismantling a lot of the, you know, the programs, and now the middle class is really struggling. The prices are getting higher. There's not a lot of good-paying jobs. A lot of the jobs being created are entry-level jobs.
Okay, Lynn, yeah. I thank you for the call, and you're expressing a sentiment that we hear a lot out there, don't we, Steve Leisman? As a reporter, this is something that I keep coming across, this pervasive sense of insecurity, which is sort of where this program started. Any sort of final thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually would disagree just a little bit in what you said, the economic insecurity. I mean, one of the great things that this professor, the paper by Timmon and Levy make us think about is not the recent insecurity stuff, but the thing that I know has perplexed the Bush administration are their lousy poll numbers during the good times of the Bush administration. That's really one of the great facts behind their paper. The other thing, though, about inflation is that is another piece of the Washington consensus, and it grows out of the 70s, it grows out of the stagflation, is that I think down to the middle class level, people have decided they don't want to live with high inflation, and that has really given one of the places that I cover the most, the Federal Reserve, a political power that perhaps it didn't have during the 1970s of low inflation. And when the woman there, the caller, talks about problems with inflation, that really says, you know what we need to do? We need to hike interest rates. put the economy, slow the economy down, the actual fix for that problem is one that is in line with the Washington Consensus rather than the Treaty of Detroit.
And Steve Leisman, I think we have to leave it there because we're out of time. Obviously, this is a debate that we had no intention of settling today, but we appreciate everybody's participation. Peter Temin, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Brink Lindsey, vice president for research at the Cato Institute, many thanks for your thoughts today.
It was a great pleasure.
And Steve Leisman, senior economics reporter for CNBC, thank you.
Thanks.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wybe, with help from Sam Gail Rosen and Will Roselip. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.